Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Welcome, everybody, to episode number 23 of the Property Wizard. A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Kieran Doherty. Without him, we just wouldn't sound as good as we like to think we do. And supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Caroline Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for a wonderful effort. So let's have a quick recap on the previous podcast where we had Eric Sonego speak to us about real estate accounting. What did you think of that?
It was a good chat, and being incorporated matters a lot. Getting things squared away ahead of time before you hit the wall, making sure CRA is well fed so they don't come after you is also a really important facet. And if you're structured everything well, if you have partners involved, everybody's on the same page at the same time, so all the paperwork's in place, makes for a lot smoother and easier times, especially when things start to get panicky. Not so much that you're panicked with your partner, but you know, if there are any stresses in the business rolling in, then you know you have some ground rules laid out and your accountant is there to help you, much like your lawyer is or your realtor.
Absolutely. I thought it was really, really informative. Eric really emphasized the importance of keeping careful records. The last thing any accountant wants to see is just a box full of receipts show up at his door. There's some real cost savings if you categorize and keep careful books when it comes tax time. So if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to it because it was a really, really informative one. You've got mail. Anything in the mailbag today?
Arnie from Edmonton has a question. He's gotten to the point where he needs to hire a property manager. What are the things he should be looking out for or asking about?
Great question, Arnie. Thank you very much for writing in. Well, probably the first thing I would look for or recommend is try to find yourself a property manager who has a professional designation. It doesn't have to be a CPM, which for those who don't know, is a certified property manager. That's kind of the pinnacle of property management expertise. But there are several other lesser designations and individuals with years of experience who will be able to help you out. That's number one. Referring back to my previous answer, again, experience, as we're so fond of saying here on the Property Wizard, is the best teacher. So if you can't find a property manager with a designation, try to find one who has a fair bit of experience dealing with the type of property that you're asking them to manage. There's a big difference between residential property management and commercial property management. So keep that in mind. Try to find somebody with the experience managing the property that you own or would like to get managed. Probably one of the best ways to find that property manager is through other members of your investment team. Ask for references. Don't be shy about asking for references. Any property manager with any type of experience should be more than able to provide you with adequate references and people that you can actually pick up the phone and speak to. So, probably another point that I would like to make is just re-emphasizing a previous point. Make sure that the firm or the individual you're asking to be a property manager for you has experience again with the type of property that you have. The last thing that I'd like to draw your attention to is make sure you have a clearly defined management agreement, because that at the end of the day is going to be what guides the relationship between you and the property manager. It's not good enough to pick up the phone and say, I want you to manage my property. How much are you going to charge? And leave it at that. Make sure that you have a clearly defined management agreement. Most property management firms provide you with an actual agreement that they've prepared. Make sure that you have it reviewed by your lawyer. Remember, that's going to be the guiding artifact when it comes to any type of potential dispute between you and the property manager. So I hope I answered your question. Thank you very much, Arnie.
This one's from Jessica, and she's in Alexandria, Virginia. She wants to know, what is the difference between gross income and gross potential income?
Great question. Now we're really getting into it. First and foremost, thank you, Jessica. Wonderful to hear from our fans in Alexandria. Well, what's the difference? Let's deal with some definitions. Gross income is the actual income derived from all sources and is most often seen in an annual income statement. For instance, your accountant would prepare a statement that doesn't necessarily break down where all the income comes from. You know, it could be broken down into, you know, rental income, parking income, laundry income. But at the bottom of that tally, the line item is referred to as gross income. Now, that's important to kind of keep in mind because gross potential income is different. Gross potential income is the maximum rent that can be derived from 100% occupancy at market rent over the course of a calendar year. So I don't know whether I'm making that quite clear. One, gross income is the actual income that you've received, and you're going to see that on an income statement. Gross potential income doesn't take the actual income that you've received into account. What it does, it's suggestive of what the maximum rent that property can generate. Now, anything less than market rent is attributable to what's called loss to lease. And you'll see this terminology used in appraisals. It is not necessarily a residential application. It can be used as such, but usually you'll see the reference to gross potential income and items like a loss to lease, which is anything less than what the market rent may be, referred to in a property appraisal or when appraising vacant or newly built properties. There's a fine line there, and I don't mean to confuse you, and I hope I've answered the question for you. Remember, gross income is just that. It's an actual figure, which you're going to see on an income statement. It can be referenced when dealing with a retail plaza, commercial plaza, even a single family home. Gross income is just that. It's the gross amount of money that you've deposited into your bank account. But gross potential income is something different. It's not based on what it is you've received. It's based on, as the term potential refers to, the potential income of the property. So, you know, again, you're going to use that figure when analyzing a distressed property, for instance. Maybe you're taking over a property that's half vacant. What you're going to want to do when you're analyzing that property is you are going to want to try to anticipate what you're going to be able to rent that property for. And that would all fall under the auspices of gross potential income. I really hope that I've been able to answer that for you, Jessica.
If you have any questions, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. It's info@gentryres.com. And Fred, there are no problems.
There are no opportunities.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Today, I have a comment about an article that's entitled Ottawa Reveals Plan to Welcome 500,000 Immigrants per Year by 2025. The article was written by CBC's Peter Zamanjic. And I apologize if I've mispronounced Peter's last name, but we do the best we can here. Anyways, the reason why I brought this up, and I just want to paraphrase part of what he's written. The BCC, which is the Business Council of Canada, says that a recent survey of its members found that 67% of its members had canceled or delayed major projects because they could not find workers, which is an amazing statistic. It goes on to say that the same group also said that 30% of its members reported that they were forced to relocate work outside of Canada because of the labor shortage. So the idea that the federal government is planning this massive increase in the number of immigrants entering Canada, I mean, 500,000 people by 2025, and that's 500,000 people per year by 2025, really points to a very interesting problem. And like we're so fond of saying here on the Property Wizard, if there are no problems, Bernie,
there are no opportunities.
Great. So where's the opportunity here? This potential flood of new immigrants have to live somewhere. So for the small property owner, small investor, this is a wonderful opportunity to take advantage of a massive influx of new peoples that need a place to live. Now, this is going to add considerably to the shortage of affordable accommodation, which should only, as a property investor or real estate investor, spur you on to turn around and create and fulfill that need. So again, keep that in mind. In the province of Ontario, they've introduced a number of varying programs and incentives for people to build new rental accommodation, and add that to what we're discussing on this podcast, that being that there's going to be up to 500,000 new immigrants coming into Canada for the next several years, and you have a recipe for phenomenal success. Take advantage of the current market trends. Take advantage of the fact that there are provincial incentives, at least in the province of Ontario, and those are duplicated in many varying forms throughout the US and throughout other provinces. Take advantage of those. Take advantage of this information and build and develop and invest in real estate with confidence. And that's all I'm going to say about that. Listeners, today it is my sincere pleasure to introduce to you our next podcast guest, Joe Narodder. I've known Joe for several years. He's a past client and he is a successful entrepreneur in his own right. Joe made his bones in the restaurant, bar, and hotel industries. He started as a busboy, became a waiter, and then a bartender. And pretty much he did it all over the world. Eventually, he ended up as a managing partner of a hotel in the Dominican Republic. He also worked as a consultant on development projects in the Dominican Republic and did a stint as vice president of a Dominican firm, which provided mediation services and negotiation training for executives. Joe says that he is supposed to be semi-retired now, but made the mistake of starting a passion project, a martial arts academy. And to use his words, things got out of hand and now it's a full-time gig. Joe also co-founded and remains involved with a martial arts program in the Dominican Republic that continues to serve the community's youth at risk and is both running well and expanding. Joe bought a duplex in Montreal a little less than 20 years ago when he thought he was going to live there indefinitely. But when he eventually moved, he decided to keep it as a rental property. Great move, Joe. Really great move. Joe purchased a fourplex in Ottawa just rather recently in October 2020, which in part was spurred on by a desire to move funds out of the underperforming stock market and a need to relocate into a school district for his high school age children. Joe subsequently has moved into the property as in the process of renovating his family home to prepare for renters. Joe describes his investment goals the following way. I'm thinking generationally. I'd like to provide my kids a leg up on property ownership, which is becoming increasingly difficult. If I can get them to start on first base, I'll be content. Great philosophy, Joe. Something that we really expound here on the Property Wizard. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Fred. Good to meet you, Bernie.
Nice to meet you too, Joe.
Super. Great. It's like old school week here. Wonderful. So let's get right into this. Joe, I know a little bit about your background, family-wise, but what attracts you to the world of real estate investing?
Well, first of all, they're not making any more of it. And in the current construction environment, there's no way building can keep up with demand. It's never going to be obsolete. Secondly, and personally, for me, it's forced savings. You got to make your payments every month, whether you want to or not. Now, as an entrepreneur my whole life, my lifestyle is pretty elastic. When I make a bit more money, I spend a bit more money. So my lifestyle adapts to my income. This sort of investment precludes that. If I put money into an investment, it stays there. I can't touch it for the long term. That's very important to me. But most important, it's simple math. I'm leveraging my investment. I'm obtaining a greater return to risk ratio than any other investment I could think of.
Fantastic. That holds so true with everything that we preach here during this podcast. It really, really resonates, and I'm sure it will with our listeners, really. Bernie, what do you think of that?
It's a very sound idea. You know, you earn a bit more money, you spend a bit more money, but this kind of secures it. right? It stops you from overspending. When did you first start out getting into the real estate investment arena?
I'd have to say I was around 30 or so. Now, I'd spent much of my time before then, you know, moving from country to country. And as such, real estate at the time didn't seem to be the move. Now I have the same regrets everyone who didn't regret invest 10, 20, 30 years ago has. I wish I had.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that true? Right. Our last show, I spent a considerable amount of time explaining to our listeners how some real estate investors are guilty of being a little short-sighted when the real benefit in investing in real estate is realized years down the road. There isn't any magic formula. At the end of the day, I believe we commented, Bernie, last show about how a single purchase of a townhouse, a condominium or strata unit, you don't have to own 100 doors or 200 doors or 1,000 doors. If you're headed down in that direction, wonderful, beautiful, great. But just the purchase of another single residential unit, like I said, a townhouse or condominium unit, can make a huge difference to you down the road, particularly when it's time to retire. And there's so many people that maybe have reached, you know, their later years that are thinking about retiring, and they're looking over at their neighbor who maybe did make a wise investment in real estate. Maybe it was another single family home. Maybe it was a townhouse. And they ask themselves, you know what, I should have done that. So good for you for realizing that. When you consider an investment, Joe, in real estate, what considerations are of paramount importance to you?
I'm a fan of residential over commercial or retail, mainly because I understand it better. It's pretty straightforward. Now I'm looking at return on investment balanced against what sort of tenant I can expect to attract. So I'm not trying to purchase a full-time job, or I'm not trying to run a rooming house. And I don't ever want to have to go before the landlord-tenant board because my tenants couldn't or wouldn't pay the rent. I want a property in an attractive neighborhood that's going to attract tenants who will pay a premium for a nice, maybe not luxurious, property. Now, personally, I want to know how much, in terms of percentage and absolute dollars, I have to put down to make the property revenue neutral. I want to put enough down that I don't have to reach into my pocket every month. I'm not looking to flip a property in the short term, but rather to acquire some properties I can hold, maybe refinance to acquire more properties down the road, with the long-term goal of passing down to my kids to continue that cycle. As far as conditions of the property goes, I'm looking for good bones on an ugly property. An ugly property has a built-in discount, and it's relatively easily addressed, but structural issues can be a major cost and are really outside my level of competency.
Fantastic. Boy, oh boy, you sound like you've been listening to our podcast. What a dead on assessment. Perfect. Good for you. And to our listeners, what Joe is talking about are, in some cases, what we call, again, a distressed property. He's looking for those properties that are undervalued because maybe there's an issue. Maybe there's an issue, a tenancy issue, or maybe there's an issue with the property itself. But as Joe has so aptly pointed out, as long as it's got good bones, the sky's the limit. That's great. What do you think, Bernie?
I like that idea. You know, if it has a certain ugly factor, but it's not a hard one to resolve, you can get past that. So it's taking out the emotions out of it and just, you know, look at it at face value.
Yeah.
So, Joe, what are you working on right now?
Well, right now I'm working on severing a property I recently bought, and then I'm going to plan a build. Probably a triplex if the Ontario government passes the proposed bill. If not, then a duplex. I'm in an R2 neighborhood. My wife works at the Canada Green Building Council, so she's more than up to speed on all the sustainable building. And of course, is insisting that any build has to be cutting edge. So we're going to build either a duplex or a triplex, which, you know, it's going to be a bit more expensive to build, but it'll have a significantly lower carrying cost in terms of heating, hydro, and all that stuff. We're going to have better air quality, et cetera. And it'll hopefully be more attractive to certain renters, all of which I expect to translate to the bottom line, both operationally and in terms of appreciation. Now, bear in mind, I'm looking to invest long-term, so it makes sense to me to get ahead of the curve on a new build to remain competitive through the life cycle of the building.
Interesting. Do you also factor in the heating platform you're using or to, you know, have that long-range ROI?
Very much so. By building to the current cutting-edge specs, I can save long-term in heating costs, and that's going to translate right to the bottom of the page. And as well, as I mentioned before, I'm going to stay ahead of the curve so the building we build is not going to be obsolete compared to other buildings in 10 years and 15 years. It's a long play for us.
Yeah, and it's really important to keep in mind that you're going to attract a better quality tenant. They're going to appreciate the fact that the utilities, which they more than likely will be responsible for, are going to be somewhat less because the property is well insulated and well constructed. And these are all things that are pluses, particularly when you're looking for a better quality tenant. So brilliant. So can you take us through the steps as to how you found this particular property?
Sure. It's an interesting story, actually. I was looking to get some funds out of the stock market. I saw things going the wrong direction, and I wanted to put them somewhere safer. At the same time, we were looking for a different school district for the kids. So another rental property ticked those boxes for me. So I spoke with you, Fred, and I let you know more what I was looking for. You and I had worked together before, so it was an easy call to make. And frankly, I enjoyed working with you. So I went and drew up an Excel worksheet for myself, and I tracked the numbers of every property I was interested in. Anything that came across my desk, anything you sent me, anything I found on my own, I just write down the expenses, tax, all that stuff. I assumed a 5% vacancy rate, a 1% fund for renovations, and then guesstimated a 1.5% yearly rental increase. So I did that spreadsheet and just compared across all the duplex, triplex, fourplexes I saw that even remotely interested me, and a long list of them, so I had comparables. Now, when I saw something I liked, and which had decent numbers on my spreadsheet, either because you sent it to me or I saw it posted somewhere, I'd flag it, make an appointment with you, we'd go see it. Now, you'll remember we put a few offers in on a few properties, and you're going to remember how competitive the market was at the time. So while I was out looking for a particularly high return on investment listing, it looked really good on my spreadsheets, it was a disaster. And you suggest I looked at another property that I didn't really much care for. The numbers weren't what I was looking for, wasn't that appealing to me. But you saw it differently and saw a little upside to it. So I'm like, all right, fine, let's go take a look at it. We'll humor them. But it was an intriguing property. It was a legal fourplex in an R2 neighborhood. There's only really supposed to be a duplex, but somehow they got a legal fourplex in there. So that piqued my interest. And since I've been looking for like over a year with not very much luck in the market, you know, I gave it some thorough thought. Now, one of the reasons is because in the past, I'd looked at properties that I quite liked and you told me you didn't much care for. So now that I didn't like a property, you did like it, I had to pay attention to that, to be honest with you. So I listened, I thought about it, I spoke to the missus about the pros and cons, and we decided to make an offer. Now, the funny thing for me was she was out of town and gave me the green light sight unseen, which was, for me, quite impressive. So our offer was conditional on financing, which was, in that market, hard to sell. But what we did was I showed them I had a significant down payment, and I showed my approval for a previous bid that I had made on a different property. So even though I had to have a conditional financing, the seller had confidence that I could obtain that financing. And we ended up putting the deal together. We went back and forth a bit, and we purchased the property.
That's a great story. And one thing and one reason why I was really, really pushing you on it was the fact that it had an oversized lot. And from the get-go, we spoke about developing the lot next door. And it's turned out that it looks like it's going to be a very, very exciting project for you. So that's a great story. It's not always the one that makes the most sense financially, believe it or not. Sometimes there are other factors that you need to take into consideration. And in this case, the redevelopment of the property, the idea or the ability to add an addition or to sever the side lot really made a lot of sense and was a really tremendous value add. So I'm very, very happy that you're pleased with it. And I'm happy that you're taking advantage of that as well. What type of advice would you have for someone who is just starting out in the world of real estate investing, Joe?
Well, I would say the two most expensive things are experience and time. Getting experience the hard way is one of the most expensive endeavors you can possibly undertake because all of your mistakes are going to cost money. So in my experience, wherever possible, I've hired someone else's experience. It's not cheap, but it's a hell of a lot cheaper than building my own experience. So I need that person to be both competent and to have my best interest at heart. You know, one of the two is not good enough. A competent person that's not interested or someone who's interested and not competent, neither one fits the bill. So you need both. And I want someone that's going to be looking at a long-term profitable relationship with me instead of a one-off commission. And I have to remind myself all the time that intelligence is not the same as expertise. I've seen a lot of really smart people getting over their heads because they confuse those two things. I ask a lot of questions, especially dumb questions. Now, I have my pride. It hurts to ask dumb questions, but it doesn't hurt as much as losing my money because I didn't ask those questions. And the other thing I'd say is time is another one of the most expensive factors in investment. I don't think you should try to outsmart the market. The perfect time to invest was 5 years ago, and it always will be. I would suggest find something you can get into, either alone or with partners, and pull the trigger, even if it's not the best possible deal. Don't let perfect get in the way of good. This traditional form of make a wage, save a down payment for a house, that model doesn't work for most people anymore. So we have to be creative. You know, a friend of mine, by way of example, he bought a property in college and he rented out the rest of the rooms. After a few years between the rents that paid the mortgage and the increase in value, he'd accumulated a respectable down payment on a home he could never have afforded otherwise. Another friend rented a townhome in college, had roommates, and ended up living in it for over a decade, paying someone else's mortgage. They both lived very comparable day-to-day lives, But at the end, only one of them came away with equity. He got in early. He pulled the trigger. He got equity at the end of it. He didn't try to time the market. He didn't wait till everything was perfect. He pulled the trigger.
That's exactly what we speak about. That is so true. You have a wonderful way of phrasing it in easily understood manner. So good for you. That's really, really great.
So, Joe, do you have any questions for us?
I actually do. I've been desperately catching up on your podcast before doing this one, so I know what I'm getting into. And you talk a lot about joint tenancy. So my question for you is, for those of us who might be hesitating to get into a joint venture on a rental property or something else, people like myself, because we're concerned, or I'm concerned, I might need access to those funds sooner than the other partners might want to sell the property. What options would you suggest for me in terms of structuring an agreement that I can potentially get out of earlier than the time horizon of the investment? How would I go about doing that? Because that's my major barrier to entry into a deal like that.
Great question, Joe. Let me try to answer your question in two parts. The first being that before getting involved with any type of co-tenancy, you should make it a point to get involved with a group of people that have the same end goal as you do. That's first and foremost. So if you're getting involved with a group of people that say, let's hold this property for 10 years and then we'll sell it, that's fantastic. If you're getting involved with a group of people in a property where you're buying it with the idea of improving it, let's say it's a distressed property, maybe you want to go in and clean it up, you want to fill the building full of tenants and then put it back on the market and resell it, that's another goal. But it should try as much as possible be a common goal of everybody's. So I know that doesn't quite directly answer your question, but the first thing you need to do is try to invest or get involved with like-minded individuals. The second point I want to make on that is that it is very important that you have a good co-tenancy agreement. Now, I use the term co-tenancy. I don't want to confuse our listeners, although we go back and forth using the term co-tenancy and co-ownership. For those who are not familiar or haven't listened to previous podcasts, the terms are synonymous. Co-ownership in another form is co-tenancy. Co-tenancy is a form of co-ownership. So a good co-tenancy agreement outlines very clearly what the options are for a partner or for a participant in the co-tenancy if, for whatever reason, they find they need to remove themselves from the project. It wouldn't be uncommon for a co-tenancy agreement to stipulate that if you needed to remove your funds in a relatively short period of time, particularly if it's a longer-term project, the most that you could possibly ask of your partners is the amount of money you initially invested. That's first and foremost. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You could be in the middle of a reconstruction or redevelopment of the project, and you can't ask your partners to buy you out based on potential, because there's still a great deal of work that needs to be completed before you get to the vocalized goal. So that's first and foremost. And a co-tenancy agreement may or may not stipulate that. The second point in a co-tenancy agreement is that there's quite a considerable portion of that agreement that deals with just the situation you're speaking of, where one partner, again, needs to remove themselves from the co-tenancy for any variety of reasons. Those cases, you as an owner of a co-tenancy unit are free to offer the unit to an outside party, or you're free to subdivide your unit if it's a situation where you may have invested $100,000, but what you need out right now is $50,000. What you can do is you can offer that to an outside party. But the big caveat to all this is that most co-tenancy agreements will stipulate that you must offer your unit first and foremost to the remaining partners. That's really the crust of it. And most partners, you know, would jump at the opportunity for purely mathematical reasons. You know, let me make this really, really simple. Let's say you buy a co-tenancy and have invested $100,000. Let's say 5 or 6 months down the road, you need the funds for whatever reason. It's irrelevant really to the discussion, but you need the funds. Well, one of the great things about a co-tenancy is that, yes, you can offer it to an outside party, but the partners have to be given the first right of refusal. It's much easier for, let's say there were 11 co-tenancy units. Let's say you're the 11th. It's much easier for the balance of your partners or fellow co-tenants to come up with $10,000 each and pay you what you paid for your co-tenancy unit, rather than having one party turn around and write a check for $100,000. So to make a long story short, or to summarize, it wouldn't be fair to your partners, or I wouldn't be accurate in suggesting that you can buy into a co-tenancy in a matter of months later, expect a massive return by selling your unit. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. But you are free to offer it to the other partners. You are free to offer it to an outside party. And in a situation where it's a matter of how much, let's say you've owned it. Let's say it's not a short-term exercise. Let's say it's 4 or 5 years down the road. And let's suggest, as I mentioned earlier, the plan was to hold it for 10 years. But again, there's a reason why, or you need to have access to the funds. The same rules apply. But the issue then becomes, what is your share worth? If you cannot come to terms between yourself and an outside party or your partners, then what you do is you bring in an appraisal. You know, you may both want to get an appraisal. And based on the terms and conditions contained within the co-tenancy agreement, there is a formulation, or there is a way by which you may have an appraisal that says the property is worth $150,000. Maybe the partners have gotten an appraisal and they say your share is worth maybe even more. It doesn't have to be less. It could be worth $170,000. So what two reasonable individuals would do, and as a point of law, that's the way most courts would look at it. They'd say, well, this is pretty easy. You know, let's compromise at $160,000. And that is what you can expect to receive either from your partners or from an outside party. That would be considered fair. Now, there are other factors that fall into that, Joe. It could be, you know, maybe you need the money immediately. You know, maybe you want to borrow the money from one of the other partners to get you through the situation that you're in, because that's also allowed and can be arranged for. There's any number of ways to, you know, essentially solve the issue or your concern. But what I'm saying is that the co-tenancy agreement as a whole spends considerable time dealing with just that issue. So get yourself a really good co-tenancy agreement. That would be my suggestion. I hope I answered your question. Anything else for us, Joe?
And on a related note, knowledge is not the same as expertise. Now, I want to gain as much knowledge about the real estate market as I possibly can, but not so I can do it all myself. I'm still going to hire an expert with the experience to guide me through it. It's more so I have the context with which to speak to this expert. I don't even know what questions to ask until I start educating myself on the market. And worse, I have no idea what I don't know. There's so much out there that I have no idea what it is. So I'm desperately trying to get as much information as I can, as much knowledge as I can, to put me in a situation to say, okay, now I know what question to ask. Now I know how to work with this expert. Absent that, I'm just shooting darts in the dark.
Wow, that is incredible insight, Joe. I wish more investors and people that are thinking about entering the real estate market really adopted that approach. I don't know how unusual, you know, that is to be asked that question. But at the end of the day, we had a guest on the podcast, a lawyer in Toronto by the name of Avi Rosen, who I remember posing that question to him. What do you think is the most important aspect of investing in real estate? And he very quickly off the mark, you'll remember Bernie said, educate yourself. Read, take courses, do what it is you can to know, you know, gather as much intelligence as you can before making a decision. So what I would suggest, and as Bernie has alluded to earlier during the podcast, we do have a rather exhaustive series of courses that deal just with that topic. And it's graduated, meaning it starts with a very, very basic theme and moves into, in course two, investment real estate, which is a little more math extensive. And the final course in that series has to do with co-tenancies. So at the end of the day, knowledge is very, very, and it's just not knowledge from one source, but taking and educating yourself is key to successful real estate investment. And the second thing that goes hand in hand with that is, as you so beautifully alluded to while answering a previous question, The other thing that's so very important is buying, and I love that term, buying expertise. Buying or associating yourselves with individuals and people that have the experience and expertise that you lack. And never be afraid to ask questions. There's no such thing as a silly or stupid question, particularly when it comes to investing in real estate. Joe, really, like, I can't emphasize that enough. You know, and sometimes we're going over the same items time, and it may seem time again, particularly when we're answering emails or questions. But that's okay, because real estate is not black and white, you know, and it's a big, big investment. So you need to gather that knowledge. However you choose to do it is completely up to you. We have a wonderful series of courses. There's a number of books out there. I'd only caution our listeners, be careful about what it is you're reading, because very often the books will lead you down the wrong path. I don't know how many times I've listened or I've been sent YouTube videos where people are expounding the benefits or the ideas of one real estate investment over another. As our previous guest alluded to, you're not going to find your real estate investment on YouTube or Instagram or Facebook. That is the wrong approach to take. It is a lazy way to go about investing in real estate, because first and foremost, you need to turn around and educate yourself. And then surround yourself with the people that have the knowledge. That would be pretty much my armchair opinion. But it may be an armchair opinion, but at the same time, it's an experienced opinion. Does that answer your question?
Very much so. Couldn't agree more with all of that.
Beautiful. That's great. Well, do you have anything further to add, Bernie?
I think we've kind of captured it all. And even if you have a certain skill set, let's say you're really competent at finances, it's always the team. You need your legal counsel, you need your mechanical engineer, if it's structural, your HVAC engineer, if it's the platform, right? If you're going green, finding LEED certification, and what does that mean, right? And if you don't know, you can go to YouTube, but you know, the expert, that's where they work. That's they live and breathe that. So they give you the most up-to-date information to work with. That's the key about a good team. You know, each element provides that knowledge base then and there. You know where you want to be, much like I can change the oil in my car. I'd rather let the mechanic do it, because if there's something else underneath that hood that's not right, they can fix it, because you know there are no problems.
There are no opportunities. Now, just for clarification, listeners, it's not that I have anything against YouTube or Instagram or any of those social media forums when it comes to looking for specific advice or direction about maybe changing your oil, but not when it comes to a real estate investment, not at all. And as we discussed last podcast, a lot of these forums and a lot of these people expounding these real estate opportunities are completely ignorant of the law. At the end of the day, you can't broadcast or suggest to hundreds, potentially thousands of people that this is the right real estate investment for you. But I don't want to argue that point anymore. Listen to our previous podcast, the one with Daryl Bondoro, right? He was the one who came on and spoke about legislation. Exactly,
and
exactly.
Also doing, you know, much like you talked about earlier with how do you pick the property manager? References, you know, what have you done? Where are you active right now? Let me see the proof in the pudding. That's going to be the reality check, whether that's a bona fide person to deal with or a bona fide business to deal with.
All great advice. Joe, thank you for being our guest today. I'm sure our listeners will have all sorts of questions for you. What's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Well, it's shameless plug time. You mentioned my passion project, so let's kill two birds with one stone, and I'll give you my Martial Arts Academy's email address. It's coach@delacosta.ca. That's DelaCosta.ca, not .com. That way, if your listeners want to learn how to defend themselves or just get fit, or more importantly, if they have kids who need some self-confidence, just get them away from their screens, they can send them my way. And I'm happy to answer any questions about my investments as well and how I stumbled my way through into being a real estate investor.
Great. Thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure having you on.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
Bernie, you want to introduce the word of the day?
Freddie, it's called cash on cash rate of return.
The cash on cash rate of return is exactly what it sounds like. It is the investor's rate of return on their initial investment. This is usually calculated using before tax cash flow versus post or after tax cash flow. I hope everybody understands that. I'm going to repeat it. It is usually calculated using before tax cash flow versus post or after tax cash flow. It's also sometimes referred to as return on equity or ROE. It can get rather complicated, but for most of our listeners, just understanding what cash on cash rate of return is will help them along their way, because very often you'll hear people talk about cash on cash rate of return. Well, you can break that right down to several different subcategories, but for the benefit of this podcast, it's exactly what it sounds like. Again, thank you for listening. And remember, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Great stuff. Until next time. Thanks, listeners.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.